From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the Boy Scouts of America expected to announce today that it is ending a longtime ban on gay scout leaders. Now, the change is expected to allow individual troops to choose leaders with similar beliefs, so troops that want to would be able to welcome gay leaders, and troops with certain religious affiliations could still turn them away.
And let's get more on this from Zach Walls. He's the executive director of Scouts for Equality, which has been working to end discrimination in the Boy Scouts. He's with us from Washington. Zach, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
You're an Eagle Scout, and you were raised also by two moms. So what does this mean to you personally?
Look, if the Boy Scouts take this step today, like we're expecting them to, it's going to be a pretty monumental step. You know, I joined the Cub Scouts when I was 6 years old. I was lucky enough to have my two moms be able to be a part of my scouting experience. And today's decision is going to make sure that both gay scouts and potentially gay adults across the country don't have to be afraid anymore.
As you know, the change will still allow individual troops to continue choosing adult leaders whose beliefs are consistent with their own. So in other words, if you're a church group and you still want to make a decision to ban gay leaders, you can still do so. What do you make of that?
Well, right. So about 70% of Boy Scout units are chartered or legally sponsored by churches. And what this resolution would do would be to prevent any discrimination for groups that are not chartered by churches, but allow churches to continue to select leaders who are in line with their religious beliefs without regard to sexual orientation, but in line with their religious beliefs.
Is that enough for you?
Well, so our position from day one has always been that discrimination sends a harmful message to kids, gay and straight, and that discrimination has no place in scouting. That being said, there's no doubt that this decision will lead to less discrimination in scouting, and that's a good thing.
As you said, 70% of the troops are sponsored by religious organizations. You know, and some might say, well, what's wrong with being respectful of a difference of opinion?
Well, I think being respectful of a difference of opinion is incredibly important, and that's exactly why we're calling for the inclusion of gay members in the Boy Scouts. We absolutely don't want people to leave the Boy Scouts, and we've never called for people to leave the Boy Scouts. Our position from day one has been that the values of scouting are universal, and that if you really believe in the values of scouting, they should be available to everyone.
Membership of the Scouts has been struggling. As you know, it's no secret. And actually, when you look at the numbers, it appears as though after 2013, when the decision to allow gay youth in the Boy Scouts was agreed upon, the numbers went down even faster. So I wonder, Zach, if you think there is a chance here that this could potentially backfire.
Well, unfortunately, the Boy Scouts membership has actually been locked in a slide since 2000, when the Boy Scouts went to the Supreme Court to defend their ban on gay members and actually won the right to continue to defend that ban. And the Boy Scouts have been going downhill basically ever since. You're absolutely right. There was a smaller than normal loss in 2013 after they ended their ban on gay youth, but it actually wasn't that much greater from the structural loss that the Boy Scouts have been seeing since 2000. I think that there absolutely will be a lot of people who walk away from the Boy Scouts after the decision to allow gay adults, and hopefully we'll also see a lot of people come back. The Boy Scouts' own research shows that about 600,000 children are being kept out of the Boy Scouts specifically because of the ban on gay adults. And hopefully those people and more will start to come back to scouting.
What do you think this entire debate over the last couple of years has done to the organization's reputation?
Well, unfortunately, it's not been good. Ever since the Boy Scouts went to the Supreme Court to defend this ban, there have been a lot of people who associate the Boy Scouts first and foremost with homophobia and with discrimination. And of course, that's not going to do good things for their reputation. Our hope is that they're able to finally take the right position and become an organization that's looking forward and not back.
The president of the Boy Scouts, Robert Gates, former CIA director, former Secretary of Defense. What do you make of his performance here? Could this have happened under any other leadership?
It's difficult to speculate on hypotheticals, but I think that he's absolutely uniquely qualified to lead this kind of organization through a leadership transition like this one. The reality is, as the Secretary of Defense and as the director of the CIA, he oversaw changes in policy with regards to gay adults, and it doesn't surprise me that he's doing the same with the Boy Scouts of America.
Boy Scouts, clearly very important to you. You've been involved since you were a child. How do you think it continues to stay relevant?
Well, the Boy Scouts at its core is not about discrimination. At the core, it's about environmental stewardship, promoting leadership ability, cultivating community service. These things are going to be in high demand in the coming years and decades, especially as we're looking at fighting something like climate change. The millennial generation is shown to be supporting community service at historic record levels. And so I think that the Boy Scouts' future in the United States of America, if they make the right decision today, looks very bright. Hmm.
Zach Walls, Executive Director of Scouts for Equality, the campaign to end discrimination in the Boy Scouts of America, responding to news today that we're expected to learn that gay scout leaders will be allowed to participate in the Boy Scouts. Zach, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Well, a surprise news conference today in Boston may be the beginning of the end of Boston's bid for the 2024 Summer Olympics. Back in January, Boston was named the candidate that the U.S. Olympic Committee will put forward in September to compete on the international stage. But here is what Boston Mayor Marty Walsh said today.
I will not sign a document that puts $1 of taxpayers' money on the line for one penny of overruns for the Olympics.
Saying there he will not sign a document that puts $1 of taxpayer money on the line for cost overruns for the Olympics. And that's been the chief concern for critics of the Olympic bid, that taxpayers would be stuck with the bill after all the cheers fade away. Kurt Nickisch is a reporter with Here Now contributor station WBUR, and he joins us in the studio. And Kurt, this was a hastily called news conference. Why is the mayor saying this now?
Well, he's saying it now because the board of the U.S. Olympic Committee was holding a teleconference this morning to check in on the bid. There's a faction on that board that would like to take the bid away from Boston and give it to Los Angeles. The mayor spoke with the CEO of the U.S. Olympic Committee before that conference call and apparently wanted to make his show of defiance or pushback ahead of that meeting.
And how much pressure have the mayor and the organizers of the bid been under from the committee, from the U.S. Olympic Committee?
Well, the mayor says that the USOC has been pressuring him to sign this taxpayer guarantee, which is signed in almost every Olympic Olympics.
They say
we'll
cover the costs if it goes over.
Yeah. Here's how much it's going to cost. You're going to put in this much. But if it goes beyond budget, who has to pay for it? The International Olympic Committee doesn't. And so typically cities sign some sort of taxpayer guarantee. There were plans here to put insurance in place to protect taxpayers. But basically, this was Marty Walsh saying that, he's not going to sign it now at this point. But publicly, they haven't been pressuring anything at all. He says that's just been happening privately.
Well, and you could see that as him saying to them, don't push me. I'm going to do what I want to do, and we're not going to sign this right now while we're trying to still work out these issues. Or you could see it as him saying, enough. My people don't want this, or at least a lot of them don't, and therefore I'm not going to bother with this anymore.
Right, or at least have that political show that he's really loyal to his people if he feels like it's going to go down anyway.
Would the Olympic Committee really dump Boston at this point and reopen the process?
They could. It wouldn't look good. But if you're going to embarrass yourself, it's better to do it earlier rather than later, right? There's still a month and a half before this September 15th deadline. That's when the USOC has to submit its American candidate city to the International Olympic Committee. So right now it's supposed to be Boston. Boston would go up against Paris and Rome and Budapest and maybe a few others. But this is really a letter or a document that has to be put together. And if they wanted to, there'd be enough time for another city to put forward.
Now, people listening to this around the country, we've been inundated by the news of the Olympics here in Boston. But around the country, it may surprise people to know that right when this bid was announced back in January, the mayor and the governor of the state, they came out, they said, great, Olympics, wonderful. And ever since then, there has been just a drumbeat of negative coverage about what would happen if the Olympics come and cost overruns and all the problems that come along with the Olympics. And now the governor saying, we'll wait and see what happens. I'm not sure that I want this. We interviewed Senator Elizabeth Warren, who came out and said she had a lot of concerns about this. But talk about some of the negativity surrounding the Olympics here.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there are sort of two elements to it. On the one hand, you have a very educated population here, and they know the stories of other cities that have spent too much money. And they just look at this a little more sophisticatedly and say, do we really need to put on a big party for the International Olympic Committee? But there's also this non-educated, but I just think there's sort of just rank and file Massachusetts. This is why there was an American Revolution here. They're just people who don't like to go along with things. I mean, the L.A. journalist Alan Abramson, he wrote yesterday that Boston is coming across as an insulated, angry group of navel-gazing NIMBYs who don't trust outsiders. And you know, there's an element of truth to that.
Well, and we should say there is a huge tech boom going on in Boston. There's a construction boom, a real estate boom going on. There are a lot of people who say this is exactly what this city needs to, you know, put itself on the map on a global stage and continue the economic boom.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the question that's being left on the table. I mean, Boston brand is going to continue to grow. If Boston loses the bid here, it's not going to really, you know, hurt the city long term. But what's left on the table is really this unique chance to get the Olympics. I mean, the chance for any U.S. city to host the 2024 Summer Games is really high because it'll have been 28 years since Atlanta hosted in 1996.
And that was the last one for the Summer Games.
So many people see this as a golden opportunity.
Kurt Nickisch, a reporter with Here and Now contributor WBUR. You can weigh in. Let us know what you think. Should Boston try to stay in the running here for the Olympics in 2024? HereandNow.org. Oil prices have hit a four-month low after the Chinese stock market dropped 8% today, the biggest one-day drop in years. So what does the drop in oil prices mean for our economy and for gas prices? Phil Flynn is senior market analyst and author of the Energy Report for the Price Futures Group in Chicago. Phil, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And if you look at this in context, how low are oil prices right now?
Well, we're at a pretty significantly low level, especially over the last couple of days, considering where we came from. You know, it was only the beginning of July we were pushing towards $63 a barrel. You know, now we're down to $47, so a significant drop in a short period of time, and a drop a lot of people didn't see coming, especially the energy companies that were really betting on a rebound in the second half of the year. Well, it looks like we're not getting that rebound yet.
And what is happening exactly? Is this about the deal with Iran? Is this about China slowing down or trouble in Europe because of Greece or just a bunch of supply on the market? What is causing this drop?
Yes, yes, and yes. I mean, there are three major issues. We started off with Greece, concerns about a slowdown in Europe. And if that wasn't enough, we got this Iranian deal. You know, there's a big question as to whether they're going to flood the global market with oil. But really, the thing that is probably the main reason why prices are down are concerns about the Chinese stock market. Just last night, the Chinese stock market had its biggest drop we've seen in over eight years. And there's a lot of concerns that their economy is slowing. And of course, you know, China is the biggest importer of oil in the world. And if their economy slows, there's going to be more oil on the globe than we need.
So one of the things that I've noticed is that unlike the last time several months ago when oil prices came down to about this level, back then, I noticed it at the gas pump pretty quickly. The price of gas dropped. Now it's not as low as it was.
It's not, but it will be. I think we had some refinery issues that kept gasoline prices high. But we did see a significant drop in gas prices over the last 2 weeks. And something of a historical nature, for the first time in 6 years, we actually saw the cost of diesel become cheaper than gasoline. I know a lot of truckers are going to say, yahoo, because they've been waiting for that for a long time. But, you know, the demand for gasoline in this country has been unbelievable. We're going to drive more miles this year than we ever have before. And refiners are producing a record amount of gasoline. So the good news is that gasoline prices will fall. The bad news is it's falling because the global economy may be slowing as well.
So is this a net positive or a net negative for the United States economy, do you think, to
That's
have
the big
oil
question.
Prices and gas prices drop?
That's the big question. I mean, initially, most people think low prices are always good for the economy. And even the Federal Reserve said that, you know, low oil prices are a net positive for the economy. But we're coming to a very significant turning point in the global economy right now. The U.S. wants to raise interest rates later this year. This possibility that the slowdown in China could affect trading partners in Europe, in India, and the rest of the globe. And one thing that we've learned from the economic crisis, you can't underestimate, you know, problems in an economy, even if it's on the other side of the earth. Because if you have a major slowdown in China, it could affect the globe and eventually affect us here at home. So we can't take this lightly. It's a big danger to the global economy. You know, in the beginning, low prices usually stimulate growth, but if they're falling for the wrong reason, that could really hurt us in the long run.
And what about production in the U.S.? Do you think a lot of people who put a lot of money into developing oil and natural gas here in the United States over the last several years are now thinking, boy, that was a mistake?
I think some of the banks that lent some of these oil companies money are saying exactly that. And even though we saw rig counts turn back up last week, they have fallen at a historic pace. And just because oil prices have collapsed over the last couple of weeks, we've already heard from oil companies that are talking about more layoffs in the energy industry, billions of dollars of capital spending cuts once again. There's going to be ramifications from the significant drop in oil. And, you know, we're going to lose jobs. And it's going to take its toll on U.S. production at some point.
Phil Flynn, a senior market analyst and author of the Energy Report for the Price Futures Group in Chicago. Phil, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, what about wind power? Right now, wind generates just about 5% of the nation's energy, but the Department of Energy says it's on course to become the country's largest source of energy, generating 35% by 2050. Joining us now is Jeremy Firestone, professor in the School of Marine Science and Policy at the University of Delaware. He's also director of the school's Center for Carbon-Free Power Integration. Professor, welcome. And do you believe those numbers, that 35% of our energy will come from wind by the year 2050?
I think, if anything, it's probably conservative. If we look at the trends on prices, land-based wind is already, in many areas of the country, the cheapest new source of energy.
So where is it all going to come from? Where are the wind farms going to be? I've seen them in Texas. There's a huge wind farm there. There are other places in the country that have some big wind farms, but it doesn't seem like there are enough of them to be that much of the power.
Well, in some of our states already, Iowa gets about 28% of its energy from the wind. And this is not a red state or blue state thing. Following just behind Iowa is South Dakota. So indeed, all of our states with increasing technology, improving technology, are going to see wind power. The turbines are much bigger, the blades are longer, and we're going to be able to put them at increasing height. All of those lead to both greater wind and greater energy capture.
Well, what is better for generating energy from wind, to have the turbines out in the ocean and have offshore wind projects, or to have them on land, or does it make a difference?
It doesn't make that much of a difference. I mean, the advantage of offshore is that the winds are generally stronger, more consistent. And during the summer, while the generation offshore is still less than it is in the winter, in the middle of the day, you do get a sea breeze, and so you will generate some power. On land, we know when it gets really hot in the summer, you don't generate much power.
And we know that there's been opposition, high-profile opposition, to a wind farm that's been in the works for a long time off the coast of Cape Cod, and it's met a lot of resistance.
It has. I think we have to look at that project as a isolated situation. The geography is really unique there. Nantucket Sound is surrounded not just by Cape Cod, but by two islands. And so you have a area in the middle of Cape Cod that's managed by the federal government, surrounded by state waters. And that's not going to repeat itself, you know, likely anywhere in the country.
Why, though, do you think offshore wind has been slower to take off than wind farms on land?
Well, it's certainly much more challenging. You've got not just wind forces on turbines, but you've got to account for wind and wave loading. The upfront capital costs are quite large. And so it becomes difficult to finance these, and we haven't really had long-term policies at the federal level in place to facilitate it. So in comparison, when Congress passed the Energy Policy Act of 2005, it provided for a 16-year planning horizon for nuclear power when it enacted a production tax credit. And the wind production tax credit is basically here 1 year, and then it stops, and then it starts again. And with something like offshore wind that has a long planning horizon, that makes it very difficult.
You need more consistency from the federal government.
You need more consistency and a longer-term vision.
How are we doing compared to other countries like China?
We've fallen behind China. We've fallen behind Japan. We're getting behind Vietnam and South Korea. So a number of the Asian countries are making progress on offshore wind. We are going to be putting in our first project off of Rhode Island, and it will be in the waters in 2016. It's a relatively small project of 5 wind turbines, but we are getting on the board. Europe, on the other hand, has got 8,000 megawatts.
And are we just talking about offshore wind or all wind projects right now?
I'm just talking about offshore wind. On land, China has at present the most installed capacity, but the United States generates the most power from wind. That's because a lot of Chinese turbines are not yet grid connected. They're up, but they're not connected to the grid.
I want to ask you one more question, and that is about the environmental impacts here, and especially when we're talking about offshore wind, the idea of birds and marine life being impacted by these. Has enough been done to address those concerns in your view?
Well, we do have 20 years of data from the Europeans. I think what we see mostly on birds, ultimately, it's going to be more an issue of habitat displacement than fatalities. The birds are perhaps smarter than we think. They can see these wind turbines a long way away and start to deflect. Marine mammals, we're going to need to do more study in the U.S., particularly with great whales. We know a lot about the installation impacts to whales and how to mitigate those, but we still don't know as much about the long-term consequences as we would like.
Jeremy Firestone, thank you so much.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Jeremy Firestone, a professor at the School of Marine Science and Policy at the University of Delaware. He's also director of the Center for Carbon-Free Power Integration there at the school.
As we heard earlier this hour, it has been a rough day for the Chinese stock market. The Shanghai Composite fell almost 9% today, the worst drop since 2007. And really, it has been a manic summer for Chinese stocks. The Shanghai Index hit a record high in June. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News joins us now from New York. Jill, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
So what's going on? We saw some big drops a few weeks ago in China, and then things seem to stabilize after the government stepped in.
Yeah, it's amazing when you throw $800 billion around what it can do. So the Chinese authorities are kind of really looking sheepish in this moment because actually, in the year leading up to the stock market topping out in the beginning of mid-June, the Chinese regulators and even policymakers were such cheerleaders for the stock market. I mean, they literally made it as if it were like a nationalistic sense that you must buy stocks to really feel Chinese. They lowered a lot of the requirements to purchase stocks. They allowed borrowed money or margin to be used. And all of that came to a head in the middle of June. And then the authorities got a little nervous. Gosh, we ought to try to prick this bubble a little bit. Well, I don't care how big your needle is. You prick the bubble and boy, that air comes out fast. We saw about a 32% slide in Chinese shares, and then they literally reverse course. They say, we got to take steps. We got to stabilize the market, which they did. But then this morning, we wake up and we see an 8.5% drop. Just to put that in context, it's 1,500 Dow points. It's not a small day.
Well, what does this teach us then, if anything, about government intervention in China's stock market?
Well, I think that this is really an excellent lesson in that markets find their bottoms no matter what the government does. I mean, clearly, if the Chinese government wants to go out and put billions and billions and billions of dollars into their own stock market, they are going to prop it up for a while. But ultimately, if the fundamentals don't work, or if borrowed money was used to finance those purchases and all of a sudden people panic all at the same time, we have the exact same rush to the exits that we've seen in every single bubble that bursts.
Right. So now what? I mean, do we expect the Chinese to come back with even more, even though it seemed to have run out of steam?
I think they're going to. I don't think they're going to. I mean, look, there's a really a delicate balance here, right? Because the Chinese authorities are trying to convince the rest of the investment community around the world that, no, we've got a serious market. You should take us. This is for real. But it's hard to take the market for real that after every run up or run down, the government's going to intervene and do something. So I think that they're trying to let the market find its bottom, and it may be within the next 5 or 8%. Who knows? On the other hand, they don't like messiness, and that's really what we've seen. And I have to be very clear about this. Yes, the stock market is down today, the U.S. stock markets. But this is not going to have the same ripple effect here in the United States that, say, a European sell-off would have.
Right.
This is a much more contained situation.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you from our relatively comfortable perch here in the United States. I mean, we just saw the price of oil continue to fall on news of the Chinese stock market. So, Jill, we will follow this story. The Chinese stock market is a bit of a roller coaster. It's fun to check in with you from time to time.
Well, you know, I will say this. If you own international and Chinese stocks, take a deep breath, okay? You don't own 100% of that market, and you're going to have a little bit of a roller coaster, and you do have to hang on. So, honest to goodness, relax about what you're doing. You have a diversified portfolio. You probably don't need to do anything different than what you're doing right now.
All right, got it. Good advice. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News. Thanks very much. You're listening to Hear It Now.
Over the weekend, Donald Trump took aim at another of his Republican rivals, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. He said Wisconsin is doing terribly on Walker's watch.
A guy like Walker, who frankly, his state is having tremendous difficulty. I love Wisconsin. It's a great place. But, you know, he's putting debt up to the gills. The school system is a disaster because they don't have any money. I mean, you know, Walker State, Wisconsin, is a catastrophe from an economic and a financial standpoint.
Trump calling in there to CNN's State of the Union show. Well, today on the NPR show On Point, Governor Walker didn't bite back.
I'm going to let Donald Trump speak for Donald Trump. I'm not going to attack other kids. What I will tell you is I'm proud of our record in Wisconsin. It's why the voters in my state, a blue state, elected me three times.
He went on to say his rainy day fund has grown, unemployment is down in Wisconsin, and the schools are working fine. Well, one of the other stories on the campaign trail that you may have noticed is weight loss. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush has lost some significant weight this year by embracing the paleo diet. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie underwent lap band surgery 2.5 years ago, says it's the best thing he's ever done for his health. Well, our next guest says one of the best things we can all do for our health, both physical and mental health, is walk more. John Rady is an associate professor of clinical psychiatry and co-author of the book Go Wild, Free Your Body and Mind from the Afflictions of Civilization. Last May, I met up with him for a walk next to the Charles River here in Boston. John, welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be with you, and it's a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. And let's start walking while we talk. And let me ask you this. Are people doing this less? Are people walking, just aimlessly walking, less than they used to?
Right. I think they definitely are. I mean, we know through history that many people used to take constitutionals and walks after dinner and walk just like that. And many of our famous authors and painters and composers were huge walkers that would go walking for inspiration, and it was a part of their daily diet. So, yes, this aimless walking where you're just sort of enjoying the breeze and the nature is much less common.
And thinking, because when you see people walking nowadays, they probably have headphones in their ears, they're listening to something, or they're talking on their phone, or they're otherwise consumed. Maybe they're texting.
Yes, that's it. I mean, people on the street, you have to watch out for everybody because their minds are glued to their screens.
Well, what are we missing by not aimlessly walking?
Well, we're missing a lot because, you know, the fact is when we're walking, we stimulate the brain in many, many ways. And this then leads to our brain being able to pick up information. The latest article coming out of Stanford showing that if we walk for even 10 minutes, you will be more creative during the walk. You have more creative thoughts. And then sitting afterwards after a 10-minute walk. And basically, I think that what has happened is that we've turned the part of the brain on that focuses, but we're doing it in a mindless kind of way. We're doing it easily. We're not stressing to stay on something, but we're able to capture ephemeral thoughts that might come up and hold on to them rather than them drifting away.
We don't feel as though we have a task that we have to accomplish. We're just letting our mind truly wander as we wander physically.
Right. But at the same time, we're more attentive. Our working memory is better. We can play with things in our minds better. And I think that's why it leads to creative ways of thinking about things or putting things together or have transformative inspiration that might come along.
You say we actually add brain cells when we're doing exercise in a way that we don't when we're not.
Right. We're not only adding brain cells, but making the brain cells that we have that much better. Exercise as a prime mover of the brain, helping it to deal with emotional ups and downs, as well as anxiety, tension, stress, and help the brain function better. The more we exercise, the better our brain gets, the more focused we can be, and the smarter we are. All those are facts, not just idle speculation.
Now, you have seen in patients, and I want you to tell us about this, that patients who stopped exercising actually developed problems, that mental problems that you pinpointed the moment that they stopped exercising as the moment when things really started up.
Right. This it was an index case, as we say, back in the early 80s. A marathoner came to me and said, look, I think I have adult onset attention deficit disorder, which wasn't a diagnosis in those days. Well, the guy had a dual appointment at MIT and Harvard as a professor, was a MacArthur Fellow, had all the credentials in the world, and he was a marathoner. And he had to stop marathoning because he hurt his knee and couldn't run his typical 7 to 8 miles a day. So he said that at first he got depressed, which happens to most marathoners. But secondly, after his depression resolved, he couldn't pay attention. He was like a child with attention deficit disorder, was always off in dreamland or would forget things, would get aggressive too easily, ignored his friends, all the things that we see in attention deficit disorder. Well, he really did have that, and it wasn't really the medicine. I put him on medicine, and that helped quite a lot. But then eventually he got back to running, and he dropped the medicine because it was no longer necessary. And that's what we see at times with many of the people who have attentional issues or mood issues, that exercise can be self-medicating. A bout of exercise is like taking a little bit of Prozac and a little bit of Ritalin, you know, because it does the same thing. It increases our neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, just as our psychiatric drugs do, as well as having a whole host of other effects that drugs can't do.
So it really doesn't have to be walking. It could be any kind of exercise.
Well, yes, it can be any kind of exercise, but walking gives you something that we need, that motion, mobility, the moving through space. All that probably adds creative oomph to our thinking, especially if we're doing it aimlessly and it's not directed, goal-directed behavior. You know, we're not walking down the street in New York to go from 84th to 89th. You know, I mean, that's a good walk, but you're on it. You're not just dawdling along like we are now along the riverbank, which is, you know, delightful, and nature helps to stimulate all kinds of wonderful thoughts. And especially when you're not focused on something, then up comes a lot of possibilities, different thoughts, different associations. And all in all, just makes for a pleasant day, both outside yourself and inside yourself.
John Rady, how often do you walk?
I walk at least 4 times a week on just a walk on the river. I exercise almost every day, try to, in one form or another. But walking, especially with my wife, we enjoy it, and we'll go 4 to 6 miles walking rather than running.
What is your favorite place to walk in the United States? If I could transport you anywhere right now and you could go take a walk for an hour, where would you go?
I think the mountains in Colorado are my some of the favorite hikes that I've ever done have been there. And it's just beautiful, beauty all around, silent, quiet.
I took a great hike once in Oregon, right next to the Columbia River, an 11 or 13 mile hike, and you didn't even notice that you were walking that far.
Yes, those are the kinds of walks that are priceless, you know, that plus you get the added benefit of getting back into nature, which is something that we really are sorely missing in our lives.
Dr. John Rady, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His new book is Go Wild. John Rady, thanks so much for walking with me.
This has been great. What a great experience. Thank you.
We spoke to John Rady last May. You can let us know your favorite place to take a walk at our website, hereandnow.org.
Historical movements, wars, and disasters have created signature sounds in music. I'm thinking freedom songs like We Shall Overcome or Baltimore by Prince. And now, with California in its fourth year of drought, songs about that crisis are starting to emerge. Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports.
Save me from this drought.
Alex Masters is a 20-something Nashville-based pop country singer who wrote her song Drought after having a tough 2012.
The song Drought came from a personal drought that I was having, questioning kind of everything in my life. What am I doing? Just feeling dried up somewhat as a person.
Masters came to California to record her music video for the song at the Salton Sea in the Coachella Valley, where the effects of drought were evident. Dry ground, a parched lake, and dead fish.
Rain me in, pour it down. Only love can save me now. Save me. Save me from this drought.
Masters isn't the only artist creating music inspired by the drought in California.
The story of the song is a father calling his son and saying, things aren't looking good, the well's running out of water.
Daddy called this morning, said the neighbor's well went dry. By the way, your pump's been running, I'm afraid we're next in line.
In response to the ill report from Costa's father's corn and cotton farm in California's Central Valley, Joseph Costa and Martina Otterbeck of the band Terrabella wrote the song Drought. Costa and Otterbeck are from Central California and now create country music in Nashville.
Here I stand, shovel in my hand, kicking and cussing the dust. The only rain we get, don't even get our clothes wet. It's enough to get our hopes up. All the sweat and tears at this farm town fall from the clouds. There'll never be another drought.
Because of this historic drought, drying wells on farms and private homes in Central California are commonplace. But in Southern California, conversation about the slow disaster sounds different. Take the heavy rock band Deep Valley.
This song is called Drought.
Julie Edwards and Lindsay Troy have performed around the globe at festivals with groups like Iggy Pop. They wrote their song Drought in 2012, reflecting on life in the San Fernando Valley. Julie Edwards remembers hot summers, popsicles, sprinklers, and drought ads on billboards.
We took the backdrop of a drought rather than focus on the restrictions of it. We wanted to play with it. But we were making kind of a sultry, swampy, hot, sweaty, sexy song.
Perhaps the most recent drought song created is by Dr. Benjamin Boone in Fresno, California. Earlier this year, Boone, a composer and professor at Fresno State, was commissioned to create a symphony.
There were clouds between him and the stars. Not ordinary ones, but dark and gloomy. And if rain had begun to fall, he said, could be drinking plan.
He decided to weave a narrative about water and drought together. Boone used recordings of former U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine and then composed orchestral music around the narrative. The symphony starts out wet and rainy, and by the end, the drought is at hand. Two 44-quart bowls are played as instruments. There are thunderstorms, and at times, a faint trickle of water dripping can be heard.
Water, clear and cold.
The water at the beginning is coming down really steadily. At the very end, when they're holding up water bowls with drips, it's just barely dripping, and you don't know when it's going to run out or if it's going to run out. And my hope is they time it so that you might get one drop per 10 seconds. Beautiful, but in a bittersweet way after hearing thunderstorms and hearing raindrops and all of that.
The world was new. The world was clear, rain fell. It has no.
The drought is showing no signs of letting up, and the hottest and driest part of the summer is upon us. So just maybe there'll be more songs about the drought in the West to hit the charts. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero in Fresno.
Rain clouds, cool our feet.